time opening. We have an eye, sort of a nostril, two teeth. One of the teeth has a small cavity. Close call, folks, but I think we got here just in time.
Presented by Maria Menounos and Kevin Undergaro, this is Anatomy of a Movie. In-depth discussions and breakdowns of various movie titles. And now that you've seen the movie, let the dissection begin.
Well, hello, movie fans. This is Dimitri Panos with Anatomy of a Movie as part of the Popcorn Talk Network now, which is 24/7, all movies, all the time. And we are Anatomy of the Movie. And to my right is the wonderful Sarah Stretton.
Hello, Dimitri. Good to be here.
We were just talking about, you know, it always seems that it's very few and far in between where we do these things together, like without our esteemed panel. Which we miss, but I love doing these with you. And you're saying like it was a couple of weeks ago. And for me, it always seems like it's forever ago. Not that it's not memorable. Maybe I just want we should do it more often.
We also just do a lot of movies. You talk about ton of movies.
That's so true.
Sometimes time can get a little confusing.
Yeah, like in Interstellar. Well, but today we are talking about a movie. This movie is The Imitation Game. A lot of hype, pre-Oscar buzz on this movie. And we will talk about and break this movie down to see if it's a pale imitation of other Oscar buzz-worthy movies that are out there right now. And we're going to talk about the movie, our thoughts. We'll talk about the genesis of this movie. Of course, we got to talk about the acting. We will talk about cinematography, the music. And I think we'll save for the end, because it's always fun when you do it on these movies based on a true story, fact versus fiction. How did it affect our thoughts that way as well? So why don't we just start off? What were your thoughts on the film?
Oh, my thoughts on this film. All right. So I found this film so... I really liked it. I found it stimulating and intriguing. And the funniest part to me was the part that I zoned out, which is normally the part that people get sucked into. So when they went into the depiction of the U-boats and of the bombing... And those were the points where I was like, okay, get back to story. Because I loved the story they were telling. I did not know about this Turing or what he had done or what he had accomplished.
Interesting.
So this was all new to me. All the details.
So this had to have been fascinating on that level.
Completely. Because I knew how important it was, so the stakes were always high.
Sure.
And I didn't know how it was going to end up.
Right.
So I didn't have the expectation, because a lot of times in historical or biographies, you're like, well, I know this is where it's going.
Right.
Nothing's really at stake, because you're like, it's going to end well, or it's going to end this way. And for this historical story, I did not know what was going to happen. And that was a really fun spot to be in.
Interesting.
I thought that the acting was great. It made me want to look more in depth. We'll get to it later, looking more in depth. Might have actually tarnished the movie a little bit for me.
Okay.
But overall, I really enjoyed it. I think it makes you want to do puzzles, and it makes the mind fascinating, and it makes you respect people who can do this.
Sure.
And that was really fun to watch.
Excellent. For me, you know, we've talked about a couple of other Oscar contenders. One most recently was Foxcatcher, and I talked about how I got caught in the hype vortex. Mm-hmm. And this movie has had a lot of hype behind it. As a movie, Benedict Cumberbatch has been everywhere. Good for him, by the ways. and for me, I did know a little bit about Alan Turing. I knew that it was because of him that... the Enigma code was broken. I didn't know to certain depths, and we'll talk about this in a story breakdown, which was fascinating to me. Like, I knew that he was key in breaking the code or breaking the machine so that we can decipher messages and all that fun stuff. I did not know about his personal life at all and the tragedy that befell that. And the other fascinating aspect of the movie to me that I didn't know about was once discovering the key and cracking the code, how they still had to keep that a secret And that, to me, giving a prime directive kind of moral dilemma, like, what do we do? Mm-hmm. And how do we do this? That, to me, was another interesting, fascinating aspect of this movie. I thought the pacing was great. It felt like a little bit of, there was a little Alistair McLean kind of thing. The gentleman who writes Tinker Tailor, Soldier Spy, Most Wanted Man, right now I can't think of that author, Jean Le Carré, a little bit of Jean Le Carré in there. So you had the espionage, you had twists, all set within the backdrop of a drama, mm-hmm. a very human drama, a tragic drama. And I think it hit all the right beats. And for me right now, and there's still at least three movies that I have to see before making final judgment, but right now it's my best picture of the year. Why don't we talk a little bit about the story of this.
I was literally at square zero in my knowledge of this. I'm not a big, huge history buff, so I didn't know who Alan Turing was. I didn't know the title of the Enigma Code. Obviously, I knew that there were secret war messages. Obviously, you know that things are going back and forth, that things are encrypted, but I didn't know the scale of it, and I didn't even know that the Germans were really that ahead at the base of it. So all of this information was new to me, and I thought that they portrayed it very well and in a way that I could grasp very quickly what was going on, what needed to happen. I didn't feel like anyone was talking down to me. I felt like all of the preparation into this story was handled very well.
Fantastic point about the technobabble.
Yes.
They made it as smart as these people were, because they are the smartest men in the room, much smarter than myself. Mm-hmm. You're right. Very easy to understand what they're trying to accomplish.
It was a great balance of understanding what they were trying to accomplish, what they were faced with, and being able to recognize they were smart and keep up with them, but not feel like I don't belong to be watching this movie.
Sure.
So I thought that was a very key space they got to, that almost anyone could watch this movie and find something they identify with. Like, you don't have to be in love with math to love this movie. Nope. And because there was the math sector, there was the character sector, and how they seamlessly put that together to kind of really include their audience.
Right.
That was done really well.
Yeah, no, and I agree. It was funny because there were aspects when I was watching it, it harkened up a movie that was somewhat based in history, very much embellished, but it was called U-571. Starred Matthew McConaughey, Bill Paxton, Jonathan Mostow had directed that film. And what that movie is about is the actual capturing of the Enigma machine, was the capture of that, and it took place on U-boats. I'm not entirely sure that the capture of the machine took place on U-boats, but this was the story, that was the movie telling the story, is how they got the actual machine. So I kept on, oh, okay, so that's the machine, that's the Enigma, that's what we're doing. You know, I had known of Alan Turing and his cryptography, again, never to the extent that the movie goes into. And I find it very cinematically, I just found it a very great cinematic tale to tell, that many people may know little. You know, I'm not a huge historian. I don't pretend to know, and I didn't pretend to know going in that I knew a lot about Alan Turing. But I thought cinematically, this movie brought out key points. It didn't necessarily, where it may have fudged with characters, we'll talk about that, it didn't fudge with the history of what his accomplishments did. And I also felt that This movie did something that I felt was difficult, and for me it succeeded. It had to balance this war, covert MI6 espionage, kind of break the code, and we knew what was at stake there. And then at the same time, we have the personal story about him being a closeted homosexual in a time. Now, this I didn't know. I didn't know that England was so harsh. I didn't know that there were laws in England that if you were deemed a homosexual, that you were deemed, it was a crime. against society.
I did not either.
And that, to me, like, opened up my eyes to a lot of things about England, including music. I mean, now it makes... Now the punk scene coming out of England with the Sex Pistols, the Clash, there's so much rebellion. I understand that more now. I didn't realize how harsh it was in that tragedy that went along. So...
And that, I agree, I really liked. I liked the juggling act and how they did kind of intersect these three storylines to give us the mass story. And you have how touring became who he was and what he wanted to do. And they intersected all of his more or less childhood with them, what's going on at the height of this. And then we also do get the aftermath of this, how this has affected him, what has happened. Because it would have been so... You could have made a movie just off of Breaking Enigma. That's a full movie. But they did do these three storylines.
Or you could have made a movie just about his personal life, where Enigma was secondary and his being homosexual and battling that secret. They could have made a movie just about that, too.
And it was very even.
Right,
and And also, I think a trick to that was how they tied, and this was probably... You know, they played with history a little bit, and to make things more full circle and to make the storylines connect, they would cross-reference each other.
Sure.
Where situations that he was dealing with in his schoolhood days were very much coming up again in the current and very much being referenced in the future or present, depending how you look at
right.
it. And then, simultaneously, it would go backwards, where you do get the cryptology book or the reference to Christopher's name.
Right.
All of these things were liberties that the script... took,
sure,
but I think worked well in creating this film.
Yeah, and it makes it palatable because it makes it palatable to a general audience. And naming the machine Christopher, on the grand scheme of things, it doesn't change the outcome of what things happened. It doesn't change anything. Where, and if people are paying attention to our podcasts, I came down pretty hard on Dallas Buyers Club. Because I felt the invention of characters and things, just like it made me question the authenticity of anything that happened. There was that one doctor, and I was like, well, these conversations impacted his life, and there were life-changing decisions that he made. But if that character never existed, then who was he talking to? Like, how did he come? Like, that's why I came down on this. I was thinking. In this, because I have to compare. I try to be consistent. And when I was thinking about this movie, I was like, okay, the Christopher thing.
Okay. The naming of Christopher's the machine Christopher, I believe history is called like the bomber.
Yeah. But I get it. But it doesn't impact history at all. It doesn't impact the decision that was made. You know, one key part of the movie too is the scene where one of the characters, when they break the code, it works, there's jubilation, and then they have all of the ships and the subs, they have their locations, and one of the code breakers goes, oh my god, we have to alert the ship because my brother is on them, and we got to save, you know, my brothers are on that boat that's about to be sunk in like an hour. We can save them. And Turing says, no, we can't. And when that scene was playing out, I was like going, okay, this is very coincidental. I'm going to bet that didn't happen. And it didn't.
Mm-hmm.
However, it doesn't change history. It doesn't change. And it gives the audience, it gives the moral dilemma that needs to be discussed.
That's the whole thing. It's heightening. It's showing how important and making it relatable of what their decisions actually meaning.
Absolutely.
This is the example of what's actually happening from just the words that are coming out of their mouth. It adds weight to it. It's very easy to fluff off being like, well, that boat has to stay. You can be like, oh, sad for a minute, but it'll pass faster unless you have something to cling to. Like,
absolutely.
I can see who this is affecting. I have a visual representation of what is happening. I know the weight of this conversation,
absolutely,
what it's implying. And that's what that example did. So I agree. I thought it.
And you buy into it, right?
Yeah.
Like, you believe that the decision, because then everybody sort of kind of turns and goes, he's right. And then you sort of, because at first you're like going, you're a dick. And then when everything comes out from the discussion, that's the other thing. There was discussion. It wasn't just like, well, we can't let the world know because it's going to show our cards and then they're going to do another thing. We can't have that happen. If you'd done that, you're like, well, I could sort of buy it. But they had a strong, firm, and I think there was even a punch that was thrown.
There was.
And it's a heavy scene. And then as an audience, you go, oh, yeah, I get what he's saying. Ooh, that's a moral choice. That's the prime directive. We can't interfere with this. It's going to change everything.
It was,
and it's a great scene.
Exactly.
Even though it was false, it lends and it gives an audience something to latch on to dramatically, cinematically. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. I think it was a really good choice. I have to say that the fact that we got this far in the film, like how we did get past that point,
right,
that we... From the get-go, my expectation was, okay, we have to solve this thing, and they're going to break a code, and then they're going to break a code, and then we're going to get a montage of them winning. Like, I was like...
Right.
But they did. They gave us a twist. They gave us they can break the code, but this isn't over.
Yeah.
This does have to be strategy. This is more than them. They're power players that affect the outcome of a war, but the war still has to be carried out.
Yeah.
So that, to me, was very interesting. I was totally... Not my expectations. The one thing I did catch them on, which I was like, yes, I don't know if this was obvious to everyone, was I think it was set up a little too early and a little too clearly that what was going to be the key was going to be the Heil Hitler reference. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it was the delivery of the line or like how the focus was, but they said they do, they read the weather telegram.
Sure.
Earlier in the movie.
Right.
And it's very clear, straight, like you're basically looking, I believe, at the paper. There's like not a lot of score going on that I can remember. And it was very much like, oh, that's my clue. And they gave it to me maybe over, I had a huge chunk in between the hint and the payoff.
Mm-hmm.
So I was just like waiting and waiting and waiting. And I felt like I was ahead of them. That was the only thing where I, like,
well, look
I
at
knew
you.
The whole time.
Look at you. Pat yourself on the back. Look at you.
Yeah.
Those big brains.
I was like, but, you know, at the same time, right. Like, these people have such bigger brains than me. How are they not seeing this?
Well, I didn't. I'll be honest. I didn't see it. I was really wrapped up in, well, number one, I was wrapped up in Alan Turing's character. And I loved... You know, I read a lot of science fiction, so cryptography is something in science fiction. And Alan Turing's name has come up. Neal Stephenson has written a book called Cryptonomicon, which came out some years ago. And it really is about crypt breaking, and it's revisionist history. He creates a character who works with mm-hmm. Turing in selecting which things they're going to hit and
gotcha.
Miss and do whatever. So I find that interesting. And for me, it was like, I was just like the whole, you had a group of guys just working on puzzles and trying to think it out. And then you had Alan Turing who comes in and says, it's going to take a machine to beat a machine.
Mm-hmm.
I got to create the machine that's going to do this. And how am I going to do this? And I mean, this eventually led to there being computers,
mm-hmm.
which is fascinating stuff as well. You know, because you don't necessarily think about it. But this movie does make, you know, and it doesn't even make a huge thing about it. You sort of get there on your own, but the movie does say, hey, that this guy basically was creating what we know today is to be computers. That stuff I found fascinating. I got so wrapped up in that part of it. And it was just fascinating to me, him building this computer.
And I think that they played off that. I think, this is jumping a little into marketing, but I think... For the team that built this movie, not only was the material and the story mm-hmm, great, mm-hmm. but they also really did support the whole world of this film. So, like, in the marketing, they were doing contests. They were doing
right.
crosswords. They were relating it to history, bringing
right.
Cross-referencing, like, when they would send out pictures and propaganda of the film with Turing's, mm-hmm. like, birthdays, anniversaries, like... They were very, very smart about
yeah.
it and had a lot of heart to the world and also engaging an audience in participating.
Yeah, I can tell you right now, I didn't win any of those contests.
I know there's a trip to London out there. I'm not sure if it's already been found. So if you guys really liked the puzzles in this film, you can go check
it out. Yeah, and online, too. They did the same thing. Marketing, and you can go online, and if you can figure out puzzles, you got certain scenes and stuff like that. Very smart. Mm-hmm. And so what else is very interesting about this movie is its actual genesis and how it took getting this movie completed and done, and how you find this story, and then having the wherewithal and the fortitude to say, you know something? This could make a great movie. And as in typical Hollywood, people said, no. Or they didn't even return calls. But, you know, you had this, and it came from people who worked on things like Gossip Girl and Prison Break. Mm-hmm. And when you find that they read this autobiography about Alan Turing, to have the wherewithal to say, you know what, this is a personal story, this is a drama, government and we got espionage kind of things. We got covertness. We got building a computer. We have a ticking time bomb, so to speak. We got to make this clock. The mere fact that they were able to get this movie done and made, I think, is fantastic, because I think they made the movie that they wanted to make, and they made it.
Well, luckily, so we're talking more about the inception. Yeah. Yes, it was coming from unexpected people, from the inspiration of this book. But on top of that, we're going to reference. I feel like so many of the movies we've found, we've loved here at Anatomy Movie, are coming from The Blacklist. Mm-hmm. And this one topped the 2011 Blacklist, right, which at this point, I don't know if it's... I need to congratulate the Blacklist creators, because I'm sure somewhere out there it was created to acknowledge that we do appreciate your work and we know how good it is. But now it's just become this is your second chance, because if you're on the Blacklist, that's a whole nother chance of getting made, because so many movies seem to be made off of it. Mm-hmm. So this movie came from the 2011 Blacklist. It was bought by Weinstein Company for a record $7 million.
The movie was completed. Mm-hmm. They picked it up as a distribution. The Weinsteins they didn't produce this movie.
But they had it at first. Because first, I believe, I might be wrong then, we might need to clarify, because when it was on the Blacklist, it sparked the interest of Leonardo DiCaprio. Mm-hmm. And when it sparked the interest of Leonardo DiCaprio, Weinstein wanted it.
Yeah.
But then when Leonardo DiCaprio backed out, it lost interest, who knows, when that didn't work out, then it became kind of back on the screenwriter, and then afterwards Weinstein came back to it.
They purchased it out of a festival and at the time it was an unprecedented, they paid $7 million to get that movie distributed. Right now they're just using their, personally, I think they're using the Weinstein magic, so to speak, as, you know, they're doing... Right now, it appears like they're doing the right things, releasing, picking the date, getting a great per screen or per location average.
Crazy.
Cumberbatch is out there.
Cumberbatch?
Cumberbatch. Did I say patch? Cumberbatch is out there. Every studio hopes that you can get talent to go out and stump for your film. And unfortunately, it's not the case. Regardless of whether your film is really good or bad, sometimes actors just don't like doing it. Harrison Ford he was notorious for not wanting to do a ton of interviews. He is out there. He's on every show. We were talking earlier.
Yeah.
He's a great interview.
This is what part of his appeal is. And I think that it's a different mold, and it's why people love him. JTE, who's in the booth right now, brought it up to me the other day on another show on Popcorn Talk, that he was like, what do you like about Benedict Cumberbatch? And I was like, I feel like I liked him in a lot of things. I was like, I've watched a little bit of Sherlock.
Right.
And I was like, but what I love him for, and what I think a lot of people love him for, is he is out there. He wants to communicate with his fans.
Right.
He does give those tons of interviews, not only about the Imitation Game, but just about himself.
Right.
And not from an egotistical way, but from a welcome, I'm going to be funny and quirky and say what I think and hopefully like me, and everyone seems to.
Yeah, he reminds me a lot of Tom Hiddleston, because he approaches interviews and fan events the same way. Like, I love that I'm here. You know, it's a wonderful opportunity. You guys are great. You guys put me here. I love doing this. And he comes off the same way. I love doing this. I'm here for you. I'm going to make you laugh. And
yeah, both of them
there's
don't
nothing
really,
standoffish.
Yeah, both of them don't try and put forward this, like,
yeah.
perfection
no
or
pretense.
A-lister
yeah,
thing. Absolutely. They came out here and they are very, both of them, Tom Hiddleston and Benedict Cumberbatch, willing to be funny, willing to, like, kind of just go with the flow.
They're yeah.
Like, and it's awesome. And I think that's getting Benedict Cumberbatch a lot of attention.
Yeah.
It's part of the reason I think he's booking these roles.
Yeah.
Not only is he talented.
Absolutely.
But he is approachable and people want to, like, care for him, which is also lenient for this role.
Sure.
Because he is cool, but I think he did bring that sense of you do care about him in this
Absolutely.
Movie.
Absolutely. And, you know, it is interesting because when the producers were, they came, it was, in a sense, you, again, another thing that I love about this town sometimes is happy accidents. So it was only because of trolling the internet that they stumbled upon an article in 2009 where the British Prime Minister apologized on behalf of the English government and apologized for the treatment of Turing and not giving him his rewards, the attention that he deserved for the attention that he ended up getting. And, you know, this was in 1950, he was apologizing for something that 1952, and they were like, wow, that's sort of kind of weird that in 2009, somebody would make an apology for something that happened so long ago. And when they scratched into the surface, they found this Andrew Hodges book, which was Alan Turing, The Enigma, which fits. I mean, he was an enigma wrapped in a mystery. I hate to be cliche like that, but that's true. And then when you start to set these things in motion going, wow, what a story we have here. This is a, and I love the approach that they took because this could have been more dramatic. Mm-hmm. We've said you could have made two movies out of this or three. You could have had them just as a child.
And they made it in one and it wasn't right. 4 hours.
That's and it wasn't crazy. 4 hours. The pacing I thought was great, right?
Yeah, no, very quick. Very quick for a movie that's up for a nomination and going with three storylines and to be under 2 hours.
And understandable.
That's very, very, very good.
Yeah, absolutely. And what I really like, too, is that they could have gone the route and just focused on his personal life and battling that as well as that. We wouldn't have gotten, it would have been a much dour ending, I think. And in fact, they did film another ending. Mm-hmm. We'll talk about that in a sec. But, you know, we learn that he committed suicide due to the chemical treatment that he was forced to take. Medical castration or chemical castration, as it was. They were giving him estrogen, I believe, mm-hmm. something to that effect. Some silly cocktail. And again, this just blows my mind. I had no idea that London, that England was so
harsh.
So harsh against this, and which makes it even more tragic. But they could have kept the ending that they had, which would have been really, I think, depressing and sad. I mean, it is tragic and sad, but I like the approach that they said, you know what? We want to celebrate his life. Mm-hmm. And I think that approach to me made me go, wow, I wonder if this inspires somebody to, whether they come out of the closet or it inspires somebody to if this is what their forte is, mm-hmm. you can be different. You can be mathematicians or you can be whatever. Play that geek side. Because again, we've had this year.
Well, I said earlier, I said that definitely I feel like this, it makes science and math and being a little bit off or what people describe as different, interesting and lovable and respectable.
Right.
All at once. And that was very good. And speaking to how they ended it and how they formulated this story with the three plot lines, they also made their own little code for what was going on.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. For why he was getting interviewed. They put up seeds with doubt, with different spies, with if he of his own secrets, how the turnout of the code breaking went.
Right.
So when you do have him interrogated in the beginning, from the very get-go of him sitting alone, you don't know why he's there. Mm-hmm. And to find out that he is there for something just so ridiculous that shouldn't be punishable at all, and that's what he ends up being interrogated for, and also then that no one comes in after all he's done to save him
right.
or to protect him.
There was almost you almost got the sense with that one cop, the guy that plays Tanner, the detective.
So hard.
He had poked so hard, but then it's funny that you say that because in a sense he was sort of kind of like the audience because he was like, there's something about him. He's not telling us the truth. There's something going on over here. Okay, so he's not a Russian spy. What do we? And then when the truth comes out, even he's like, oh, rubbish. Come on. No, that's not what we're getting him on.
And you can tell he felt like he wanted to take it back.
Yeah.
He felt like he was sorry for crying because now, because it's just...
I got the sense, maybe the way I interpreted that character understood Turing's relevancy mm-hmm. and accomplishments for the war.
Mm-hmm.
And he was actually interested in a lot of that which was going on, not so much the homosexual stuff. I mean, he too was like, oh, come on, it's got to be more than that. Mm-hmm. If that's it, he goes, I don't want to be, like, he almost said, like, I don't want to be a part of it. He goes, it can't be that. It's got to be more. So I find that interesting. I thought that was a fascinating part. And to your point, too, you're like, really? Like, and again,
I think that was a point of the film.
Damn that England.
I think that was a point of the film. Them saying that in all that's happened and acknowledging that's why they brought up the pardon at the end.
Right.
They do mention it even in the film that he was acknowledged by, like, the Queen. But in interviews, I don't remember which actor it was. They even said, like, if anyone should be doing the pardoning, it should be Turing because he was the one who was, like, wronged. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. So... And going back to, I think it's interesting because we were talking about how these producers and such, they came from a TV background.
Mm-hmm.
And not Gossip Girl. I'm sorry, all you Gossip Girl lovers, but I'm not saying like this is not a, you know, Gossip Girl, Prison Break. And then the writer Graham Moore was writing 10 Things I Hate About You at the time. So we're not talking like a ton.
Movie.
Yeah, we're not talking about shows that like have a lot of heft. I mean, they're entertaining shows, don't get me wrong, but I just love the combination of these folks and then Graham Moore coming in and he's like, yeah, that's a great topic for me to do. Mm-hmm. And how we approached it was, you know, you didn't have to, you know, it didn't ask you to like Turing, you just had to accept Turing. And I will give him that. For part of it, you accept Turing, but as the movie went along, you end up liking Turing. And I think that's one of the strengths because it's hard to, and I don't, how do I say this? It's hard to sympathize with an asshole unless there's something there that I can, regardless of what his preferences are and whatever, you know, and being ostracized and treated the way it was is terrible. So I don't want to be misunderstood there. But when you add that level in a screenplay, when you're able to bond with him, it makes the tragedy that much more tragic. If he had stayed an asshole through the movie, you still would have been, well, he didn't deserve that. But when you come to go, you feel bad for his lot in life, knowing how smart this guy was.
I liked him very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
I liked him. Maybe it was the casting. Maybe it was because I do like the actor so much. But I really, really felt for this character mm-hmm. right away. So they didn't have to get me to like him. They just had to get me to understand him a little.
Yeah.
And I think that they did a very good job on that end for me.
Mm-hmm.
Where I started to see how he functioned more.
We see how he functioned more.
And also how he personally grew.
Absolutely.
And no, it wasn't this huge... I don't think there was a huge... giant character arc, because to me he started off cold and distant, but he didn't start, but he had always had a heart, so it was more of him just being able to learn to try and like reach out to people and to give that like smile sometimes and be more open and being able to be vulnerable with them. And so it wasn't this giant sweeping arc that sometimes we see with our main protagonist or character. It was just like these subtle little changes, which to me was very realistic, and I liked him in the beginning.
So. And subtlety can mean a lot. But you not only saw him, Ark, and Grau, his team. Mm-hmm. His team who, you know, you can understand the hatred mm-hmm. that they had because he could be a dick sometimes. But they too, especially in that one key scene, they too end up realizing that his smarts is going to be the only thing that helps them out. Because when he was at that point of being fired, you know, the rest of his team comes in and says, well, if he gets fired, you're firing me too. Because in all honesty, and the guy even says, God, strike me down for saying, he goes, I can't believe I'm saying this. He goes, but he's your best chance.
Yeah.
Like, finishing that project is your best chance. And trust me, nobody hates him more than I do. And it was right there at that turning point. There was a little bit more bonding in a bar. I love those scenes as well, too.
Yeah. And what I'll add to it is earlier you mentioned that this is one of your top contenders of the year.
Yeah.
I don't know if that just for you means from a critical way or from an enjoyment way.
A little bit of both. Yeah.
So for me, I also have to say a little bit of both. It's really high on the rankings for me. And part of that, especially the enjoyment part, comes from when I try and narrow down the scenes I liked in this film. It is so difficult. And not only did I like so many scenes, but I liked them for different reasons.
Yeah.
Whether it be there was comic scenes like the apples, and to head it off with a joke that just was had people in my audience laughing.
Right.
Or to the other humorous scene where he's talking to, I'm going to call him Tywin Land.
right.
When he was talking to the... something with a C. Commander?
Yeah, he was the boss, the admiral guy, the military gentleman.
Commander Dunstan.
Dunstan checks
in. Yeah, so when... To their initial kind of non-joking... But joking,
their opening banter was
wonderful. But then also to the dramatic acting scenes, mm-hmm. to the closing of him really breaking down, to Keira Knightley relating to him, to the bar scene when they finally crack the code and all just run out one after another. There was so many good, great scenes in this, and for whether it was how it was shot, the acting in it, the humor in it,
mm-hmm.
they just really hit it on all different levels over this film.
Agreed. And I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I think we're going to agree on this. This is a movie that I can easily see again.
Oh, yes.
Like if somebody said, hey, I got to take you to this movie because this is a really good movie.
The rewatchability is,
I think so.
Pretty high.
And you could look at it differently and peel back the onion, but you'll be entertained. It had an entertainment factor, and that's why I think it's so important that it can reach out to a mass audience, even though there's some heavy themes going on in here. But people aren't necessarily going to walk out depressed, put off. They're going to go, oh, man, and they'll come out, like I said, maybe even inspired.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I think it goes straight back to the rewatchability, because you can go out of this and come out with something different each time.
I agree.
I think you can come out with this really thinking about the war. I think you can come out of this really thinking about the achievements this man made. I think you can come out thinking about this with just the curiosity of all the hidden gems that I'm sure are in this movie.
Right.
Or all the puzzles you want to solve.
Right.
Or what you want to read about. Or, you know, there's so much to take away from each time.
Yeah.
And that it leaves you with some mixed emotions.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Let's go back a little bit, too, because I found this. We were talking about, you know, the script found acceptance. 2011 Blacklist, it was one of the best unproduced screenplays. It was Warner Brothers who quickly snapped it up. There was a 7-figure deal, and that's where Leonardo DiCaprio came in. And Heavyweight Helmer is like, look who was looking. Sam Mendes, Tom Hooper, Ron Howard. And, you know, like this, actually, it's almost like a Ron Howard film. He's very humanistic character.
He's one of the ones on that list who I was like, I can see that.
I could see that too.
I could see
absolutely
how it could kind of fit in his
beautiful
palette.
Mind. Mm-hmm. You know, you could sort of kind of see
math beautiful,
right?
You know,
and you know, but then it was actually according to this, it was saying that it was DiCaprio's attention waned, and listen, he had other projects, and then Warner Brothers says, "Up, see you later, bye." Yeah. And you know, then you're in one of those things where, okay, now what do we do? And then they had plenty of Megan Ellison. Like, I could have seen this as an Anna Perina movie as well. Megan Ellison being producer of movies like Zero Dark Thirty, Hurt Locker and such. She has a knack for picking certain kind of movies, so I can understand her interest in this. And then, of course,
a lot dirtier.
But yeah, actually, well, yeah, her stories, you know, I think,
they're
yeah,
a little more grungy.
They can be, but she has that knack for the art, kind of the smaller film, you know, focus features, Harvey Weinstein, but nobody, it was just sat on a shelf for a while, as it so happens in this case. But it was a gentleman, a deep pocketed film investor, Teddy Schwartzman, of the Blackstone Group fame. He was blown away by the script, and he basically said, okay, we're going to do it. We're going to shoot in the UK, mm-hmm. which I thought was fantastic. Added a great flavor to it. Sort of reminded me of, what was the Judi Dench movie that we did year ago?
Philomena.
Mm-hmm. Scenes filmed in England, and we saw different parts of England mm-hmm. and such. And we're going to go back to filming.
It was Ireland.
Ireland. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I don't remember where they actually filmed, but
yeah, I just liked how, if this were in England, I liked how it was shot, and I liked the look of this movie a lot. And then it came to who are we going to hire? Who are we going to put in this movie? And you had James McAvoy, Andrew Garfield was touted about, and when Benedict Cumberbatch's name came up, they're like, nah, it's not big enough at the time, because he hadn't been in Star Trek yet. He was only in Sherlock. And yeah, he wasn't necessarily first to go. You know, he wasn't necessarily their first choice. But when you look at this guy, and if you watch Sherlock, and I'm a huge Sherlock fan, he is so amazing that I do believe he does stand up. There's Basil Rathbone, there's Benedict Cumberbatch to me. He's so amazing, so good that I can't watch the CBS Sherlock show. I don't even know what it's called. And I don't mean to disparage those people, but I love watching him on Sherlock. And then when he was in Star Trek Into Darkness, and he was in War Horse, he played a small role in War Horse. And his character in that movie was really good, too. Of course, Star Trek Into Darkness, I felt he played a great villain. I don't care what those naysayers and haters say about him being Khan. He had a presence as a villain, and he stood in the way. He caused conflict, and he was so good at it. And when you put him in this movie, you know, he's just so amazing.
He is. And this comes down to, like, everything, a lot of the things you just said, some people could take as, you know, very big hits. They've made a step forward, they took four steps back
right.
constantly. But good news for them, I think that this came out at the perfect time with the perfect person.
Oh, absolutely.
They got, whether it's, you know, sometimes timing is everything. And Benedict Cumberbatch has had a huge, you know, kind of publicity push last year, over the past couple of years, especially with Hobbit and Smaug and playing the voice. His name
sure.
was all over the tabloids. So that came out, and this is a really good spot for him because mm-hmm. people do respect him and like him. And then on top of that, the specialty box office has been doing really well
sure.
this season. So it coming out in that aspect, also kind of coming out on time around Theory of Everything, where
sure.
intellect is being more mm-hmm. acknowledged, because we've seen so many of these big, huge budget
yeah,
films.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, taking this down a notch and just going into more of a different story, I think this is coming out a really solid point for not only this actor, but the themes of this film.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree with that more, too, because I think socially and there's a lot of unrest, certain things. So, yes, I do agree that it's coming out at the right time. Let's not, you know, look, it's the Weinsteins picking it up. They knew what they had.
Mm-hmm.
Listen, you know, again, say what you will about them. But when they support you, man, they support you. They 100%, 150%, they will get you out there. They know that they have the goods, too. Okay, so we're getting a well-reviewed movie. Mm-hmm. I mean, is there any doubt in your mind that Benedict Cumberbatch gets nominated?
I would say yes, he will get nominated.
I would say that too. I mean,
I would be very surprised if he wasn't.
Same here.
And I would actually be unhappy if he wasn't.
Yeah.
Much like I was unhappy last year when for Saving Mr. Banks, we got loose. So it's possible.
You know, anything's possible in that derby.
It is possible, but I would be very surprised and very disappointed if he didn't get nominated.
Same here. Same. I would be very surprised. So, so we talked a lot, good stuff about story. And of course we talked about, Benedict Cumberbatch, but let's talk about some of the other cast because I'll be honest, I don't think anybody faltered. I thought everybody was fantastic, including Keira Knightley as, Joan Clark. Mm-hmm. She added the brightness to this movie and the spunk that was needed to offset Turing's personality. Mm-hmm.
And then she also brought it in with that final note of their final conversation where mm-hmm. she was talking one-on-one and her voice got so much deeper and so much more direct. Because she was light and she was sweet and you like, okay, I'll believe you're smart for most of the movie. Like she countered him. She was like the perfect little, you know, sidekick. Great.
And again, I don't even look at her necessarily. It was funny that you used the word sidekick. I didn't think of it that, but he relied on her in a sense, in many cases, more so than his actual team. Mm-hmm. She wasn't allowed to come, but the team eventually knew that she had an important role to fill. And again, albeit that it didn't necessarily happen with her coming in and filling out the crossword puzzle, it's a great scene, again, because A, it doesn't affect history.
Oh, you're talking about her actual entrance.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. Her initial entrance. It doesn't affect the history of the scene, and what it gives, I think, what it smartly gives to an audience is it's set up like, okay, they have to solve this puzzle within 6 minutes. Like, and Turing himself admits, I can only do it like the quickest I've done it is in like 7. So
he
they're
says
already
eight.
Yeah, eight. And is it eight? Okay, and so they're already setting out an impossible task, and I'm done. She comes. First off, there was the whole thing of Miss, the secretary pulls upstairs. No, I'm here for the, no, ma'am, you must be mistaken. She goes, no, I'm not mistaken. And as Turing was like, okay, we all sat here. And then finally he has to intercede. And he's like, okay, let her in. And he goes up there. And when she raises her hand, he's like, yes, he's like, no, I'm done. He goes, you're done. Because, well, you said you wanted it under 6 minutes. And when I check it, it's a great, again, when you talked about scenes.
It's a really good scene. It's a really good scene. It's also great because they set it up for the audience not really to completely believe in her. But Benedict's more just like, you're a person, non-judgmental. Like, yeah, a little bit surprised because anyone beat it, but not surprised because it's specifically her.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like from Turing's perspective, maybe everyone else in the room thinking differently, but from Turing's perspective, he was just surprised anyone finished it.
Right.
Like, it didn't matter that it was the woman or the man next to him. He was just going to be equal. The reaction was going to be equal if anyone did it.
I think, and it was nice that it was, you know, and plus she was a woman in definitely a man's world. There was, she was the only female there. I like that aspect of it a lot. I think it was for Keira Knightley to take on this role, great role for an actress to do. She was a strong woman. She didn't back down. The way in which her character, again, was presented was, as opposed to real life, she was stronger. I mean, she wanted to go out on her own. You know, her parents are highly conservative and you've got to be married by 25 and blah, blah, blah. But she knew that she could do this and be a part of it. Mm-hmm. She wanted to be a part of it. I thought it was a great role for her. One of the best that I've seen her in. She added so much to the movie and yet it was a smart character, a strong character. Yeah. And she even backed up Turing.
Yeah.
I love that scene. Matthew Good as Hugh Alexander. He too was great. And I was thinking, like the whole movie, I'm like, okay, so you have one of the world's greatest mathematicians. He's a chess player.
Oh, really?
He was a chess player. That's what he gets in. And I'm like going, okay, but he's like one of the world's best chess players. Okay,
he's and in the world, he won twice.
Yeah, and like okay, so I get the cryptography, but it was just funny that
took it as also like the strategic,
of course,
when it does come to war and battles, being 80 steps ahead of your opponent.
Yeah, well, they had to try to be 80 steps ahead of this code breaking. And I just thought that the dynamic that you have a person, a mathematician, and a person who's playing the game of chess. And I get the strategy behind it. And it is a very thinking man's game. Matthew Good was great.
I think he did a great job.
Again, as a supporting actor.
And they're casting for the whole team.
Yeah.
Like, everyone had... It was typecast, but everyone had fit the role. You did have him being the suave guy who could be the chess player.
Right.
You knew he got hired right away because he got the jokes and was just in there. And then you have, you know, a little bit more on the nerdy side.
Right.
One of his brothers. Then you have the very religious. But you know, buckle down, accent.
Right.
It was a very nice group of guys that they did bring together. And all of them did a really strong job. You're right.
No
one stuck out as being like, you shouldn't be there.
No. And Rory Kinnear was Detective Robert Nock, which is interesting to me anyways, because... again, this is another character that they say in history didn't really exist. And again, I'm fine with it here because his thing didn't affect story in the history of it, but it gives the audience someone who's going to either create a conflict for him. I found that his name, Robert Nock, was interesting because if we see spy movies, a common convention is... Well, Skyfall is their knock list of agents out in the field was stolen.
Mm-hmm.
So it's called a knock list. It's a list. And when you're thinking about people who may be closeted, that their names may be on a quote-unquote knock list in which the government was trying to find out who these people were to persecute and whatnot. So I found that his last name was sort of interesting. This is a guy that I just love every time. More and more I see him on screen is Mark Strong.
Yes.
As the MI6 operative Stuart Menzies.
Yes. Always kind of playing that... He's normally a villain.
Typically,
and this one, he was the good guy who's still kind of a villain.
Sort of, kind of.
You don't know whether to trust him the whole time, and he played his part really well.
He's great.
His twist came in at a perfect time. As you said, it's a really top notch.
Charles Dance, as you said, Tywin Lannister.
Mm-hmm.
And I always remember him from Last Action Hero. That was the very first movie I remember seeing him in. But Charles Dance too, again. Finding that balance, the opening scene where Turing meets Denniston.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't have a repartee with the actor, you can't pull off that scene. Because that scene comes off a bit comical.
Mm-hmm.
Turing is a little bit full of himself. And this is like a guy like... He was escorting him out the room. He's calling for his receptionist. I mean, but that scene is great.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the mere fact that he was able to spa... He and Benedict... Yeah, that repartee that they had, that patter was fantastic.
And it was hilarious.
It was great.
And it's because they weren't aiming, I don't think, for it to be funny. It just came off as funny. Overall, casting, really good job in this. It just leans itself to why this movie worked constantly.
Yeah, it's definitely one of those films where, we've talked about this, all cylinders work from a creative standpoint. And you're getting people who are not, it's unorthodox that you have... This is written from the guy who did 10 Things I Hate About You.
It's a great movie, but a very different genre.
There was a series, apparently, and you're talking about these people who you wouldn't necessarily associate with the stature of the kind of movie that this buzz is getting, this Oscar buzz. And I love how this all came together. I think that the director, Morten Tildum, did a fantastic job.
I agree.
As balancing everything.
Well, we said we were going to talk about this later, and you mentioned we were kind of mentioning it a little bit, especially as we've gotten into characters.
Sure.
Which is the adjustments they did make this film from actual history.
Right.
Which is one of the things that a lot of people are giving this film negative reviews about.
Sure.
And I think it's a really hard spot to be in. We've mentioned a lot of things that I think you've mentioned worked for you and worked for me,
mm-hmm.
whether it be the crossword puzzle challenge that does give them Joan, which
right.
is, that's bending the truth. Or whether it was the detective, them bringing in that
right.
name. Those were bends that I was completely fine with. Even down to him getting the cryptology book as a schoolboy,
right,
which wasn't noted in the biography.
No.
All of these are things that they bend, but lend themselves to, I think, the movie and to the storytelling and to kind of just merging their different storylines, really.
Yeah. I agree. And, you know, and to your point, okay, so one major thing. So the boy, Christopher, in the boarding school years, I will call it, yes, he was in fact very close, very good friends, and Christopher did die of what was it? It wasn't like swine flu, but it was a tuberculosis.
A certain type, I don't remember.
Yeah, it was a certain type of tuberculosis in which that character or that person actually did die of that. Yet Turing still remained very close with that kid's family, and they went on vacations together and all this stuff. Okay, I get it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't need to see it in the movie. Like, it, again, it doesn't change the outcome of history and the outcome of what happens. And now you're making a longer movie with filler stuff that we need to pare down. And but I under, you know,
I would,
go ahead.
I would just say that 90% of those little changes, I'm completely fine with. And it's right. It's because it's not really changing history.
Right.
The one, and there might be a couple more than one. The one main one that I actually do have a problem with.
Yeah.
And it was just coming out from the fact that I did get interested was actually Commander Denison's portrayal.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the reason I say that is because his family in particular has come out being like,
I read about that.
He was supportive. Mm-hmm. We don't feel like this really honors him. And I think that is a true point. I think that if you are going to take a character who was a real person, and if you're going to kind of make them the hurdle or the challenge,
sure,
or he's not a villain in this, but he definitely creates problems for the tract of the protagonist. If you're going to do that, then you need to clarify later that was a license, because I think that does tarnish his memory a little bit, because unless you're willing to look into, mm-hmm, you would think that the commander was not on board, did not want this fulfilled, was standing in the way of progress and help. So I'm just saying, like, that to me was the one thing, one of the one things. Because I'm like, okay, if he was supportive, which the biography indicates, the biography seems to say that Turing was really admired at the facility,
right,
that he was like the A-list student, and that the commander was all for it.
Right.
That is a very different legacy to have your family person be like, he was the one who was supporting this versus he was the one who's trying to fight it.
Yeah, I don't disagree. My only counter, and it's, you know, I guess you can, it might be a weak counter, is I never thought of Denniston being the villain. They could have had that character as, they could have made that character the villain, because it's been done in so many kind of movies where the higher official, the higher ranking officer, is a complete a-hole and really kicks the person who's got to try to make the best of what he has. And I think, at least the way I saw Denniston, was he had a job to do. He had a military job. He's in the military.
Mm-hmm.
He had a job to do. And this was an important job. He tried to put together the best team possible. This guy in the movie comes in out of nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
Don't have an appointment. He just found a job. He's like, oh, this seems like an interesting thing. And their repartee starts. And I think that at first, the character of, not the real life, but the character of Denniston understands that, you know what? This guy's smart. Yes, he can be abrasive. Yes, we're going to have this issue. But I think that ultimately the character wasn't doing it because Denniston's character wasn't doing it because out of spite. He just needed this job being done, and he found that things were being disruptive. And I didn't think that he was, I can understand how the family would say, well, he was exactly opposite that. And I get that, but I just didn't find him to be the a-hole that some people have said that he was, as far as, you know.
See,
just
I can agree that I feel like he did get to get the job done. I think it's more of looking at the exact tactics and looking at each instance, which isn't just him being like, oh, this guy's annoying, but I'm going to let it do it. It was the direct action to stop him throughout the film that I feel is disrespectful to his memory if he wasn't. I understand it's the motivation for story. And watching it, I didn't feel like it was fake. Watching it, I felt like it moved the plot along.
Yeah.
But prior to looking back, mm-hmm. being interested in this, and then to find out that, wait, he was a good guy who was on his team.
Right.
Like, I did not get that impression yeah. from the film. So for his family and for that historical yeah. person, no, I, yeah. he's not getting as much credit. And the fact that there was a couple other people who were very crucial to the creation of this machine besides Turing, I would have liked a little more acknowledgement of.
Yeah, I get it. And,
but, you know, you can't have everything.
No, and being, you know, and again, just quickly going back to Dennis, and like, you know, he just, the way that character to me was portrayed wasn't like, look, okay, we've had enough. Your thing doesn't work. Your thing doesn't work. You're gone. Nobody likes you. I need somebody who's going to get this to work and get it done right. And you're right. There were other people who were part of making the bomb, so to speak. There was another gentleman who worked on it before Turing even got there, and that they sort of worked together. And that person, and he doesn't get credit for it. The mathematician Gordon Welchman. Mm-hmm. Well, Gordon Welchman, people, he was the other guy that worked on this thing. So we're acknowledging him on Anatomy of a Movie. Mm-hmm. Outside of an article that I found on Slate, we're doing it on this podcast. But I get it. You know, if we're going to celebrate Turing and what he did, and ultimately, I think it was Turing who wanted to create the thinking machine, which eventually became the computer. I don't want to take away or disparage the Welchman family at all. But again, even to Benedict Cumberbatch is saying, look, if we put in every single detail in this movie, like, you'd still be watching it and not talking to me. And we were talking about length of mm-hmm. movies. And I think I was just a little more forgiving in this movie because of the fact that it didn't necessarily end up changing the history. Like, we know that Joan Clark, for example, you know, she wanted to go back home with her parents and whatnot, but they were shortly engaged. I should say they were engaged for a short amount of time. So that happened. She did support
yeah,
him.
Yeah, there was a lot of facts. You know. I'm not. Yeah, exactly. I kind of wanted to, because there is so much, or this is the only heat surrounding right. this movie is the discrepancies. I think it is, there is a line between what I think are completely suitable to film and then ones that I'm like, oh, I'm not so happy with that. But right. there weren't any that I was like completely horrified by.
Yeah.
There was just like a few that I was kind of like, oh, it would be better to have these people acknowledged.
Yeah. And then, you know, the whole spot. Well, see, that was another thing too that I found. When you talk about twist among twist,
mm-hmm.
let's talk about the little spy aspect. We have John Cancross, okay,
mm-hmm.
Who's one of the people working on this on the project, and it comes about through the movie that somewhere amongst the team there's a Russian spy. Somebody's feeding info to the Russians,
to the Soviets,
and the first thing is to go to Alan Turing.
Of course,
okay, they're going to go to him because he's this, like, you know, we're going to go to him, and basically. Towards the end of the movie, two revelations. Number one, somebody in the team recognizes Turing as being homosexual. He's like, yeah, I sort of kind of figured it out. And that he actually was the spy. And then the bigger twist comes when our Turing is talking with MI6 and he says, well, you know, he goes, what do you know? He goes, well, I know who the spy is. He goes, well, yeah, we knew who it was too. That's why we placed him in there to begin with. And I'm like, whoa.
Yeah.
You know, and again, that's sort of very Jean Le Carré, moving people into these positions to get all this. And I was like, that was done really well.
And it was also nice because it was just like quick.
Yeah.
And it was just like, nope, this is one example. We switched the letters. Now you get it.
Yeah. Done. And you know, we know many secrets. I got the sense that that character knew about Turing.
Of course. I'm right on that assumption with you. This is the guy who kind of knows everything before you do.
Yeah.
And it worked. And as I said, that goes to pacing. That goes to why this movie was so short, because that was a whole storyline that they did in a minute,
right.
And it didn't, and it was just like, I get it.
It was done very well.
Perfect.
It was it's an important part of the story. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about Oscar Fauna did the cinematography mm-hmm. on this. I thought the movie looked beautiful, and from a sense of from war to barn to England to war torn England. I felt the U-boat scenes looked fantastic. The airplanes, I just thought the movie looked great for me.
It was funny because I think I mentioned earlier, for me, the only scenes that ever stood out as I was like, get back to story, were often the war depiction scenes. Mm-hmm. Or like the rubble scene seemed a little strange to me, although I found it humorous about the woman like drinking coffee on her pile of rubble. And I know the art department had some trouble with that, where like the rubble wasn't ordered and they had to scrounge it around. But there's a couple of the war scenes themselves. This I actually really liked. I liked the use of old footage.
Mm-hmm.
Like that I liked. But some of the U-boat scenes stuck out to me as just kind of taking too long.
Oh, really? See, I loved all that.
Yeah, my more favorite shots of his were, like, once in a while, he would kind of throw in something a little strange. Whether it be there's one towards the beginning where he has an overhead shot of a secretary walking in and delivering a paper to a desk. And it's just straight overhead, and it's a completely, mm-hmm. like, wood floor.
Yeah.
And it's a very interesting image. Or there's one where it's, like, a coffee cup, but he's approaching it from, like, a sideways mm-hmm. angle. He would throw those shots yeah. in, and I really did like the look of them, how sometimes it would be kind of like there seemed to be a pattern mm-hmm. like there was a central focus and there was like kind of a grand scheme around
sure.
it, or those like playing with those type of images I thought looked and felt really cool and like made me think. Then the war ones,
see, I love the war ones. The scene inside the tube or the subway I thought mm-hmm. was awesome. There was another scene when you're talking about the rubble.
Mm-hmm.
It was really interesting. So the coffee, but then a bike rider goes by.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, whoa, I think that was that. And then you go to another scene of the aftermath of the rubble, and there's that bike going by again. And I was like, oh, that's Alan Turing. And then when we finish going to our various places, it is Alan Turing going yeah. to wherever. I thought that was great. I thought William Goldenberg, film editor, did a really amazing job. Again, when you talk about a juggling act, where are you going to pick your, how are you going to do your flashbacks? How are you going to get this so that an audience can understand and stay with you and make it seamless in a sense?
Yeah.
And I thought they did a fantastic job in setting up
yeah.
that as well.
And there were some really good transitions, whether it be like a knock from one scene to switching in time to a different knock. Like they did really, but it did feel very fluid, very seamless. I wasn't
necessarily confused
no.
by any. I thought the flow was great. You know, I have to talk about music. And this is why, one of the reasons I brought up Philomena.
A lot of people love the score.
Well, it's, you know, it's one of our good friends, Alexander Desplat. Not that we know him or he knows us, but man, this guy has been scoring movies insanely. We talked about him during Godzilla. We talked about him during Philomena. We talked about him doing this movie. We talked about him during Monuments Men. I mean, this guy is like, you know, he's right up there with like a Hans Zimmer. And I mean, this guy's getting projects left and right. And apparently on this movie, you know, he got this movie, and he did this in 2.5 weeks.
Oh my goodness.
About 2.5 weeks.
That's crazy.
He was able to get this music out, and it is. It's a beautiful score. As far as score goes, I thought it was very complimentary to what was happening on screen. You know, he really sets a mood and he helps set a pace. I just can't believe that this guy just does so many different types of movies.
I can't believe that he did this movie that quickly.
2.5 weeks. He said he was pretty much done. And it's interesting because you mentioned, I always remember this from you when we did Philomena.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The thing that you liked the best about his score in Philomena was the circusy aspect mm-hmm. of certain things. You know, John and I, when we did Monuments Men, we agreed and we believed one of the assets of Monuments Men was Desplat's score, because he came up with a theme that was very reminiscent of the old style Bridge Over the River Kwai, of those old style war movies, and he developed the theme that ran throughout in Godzilla, which is completely different. You know, again, he comes up with a menacing reptilian monster theme that works really great. And in this movie, he's able to balance the drama along with the espionage drama, and it helps the pace. I think the music in this movie it could end up being nominated.
I agree. I do think this one's going to be nominated. It's like that hint of foreboding in this one.
Sure. Certain scenes, yeah. And I'm going to say something else stuck out for me. We don't normally talk about it. Costumes. I love the way that the women were dressed in this movie. I loved that it wasn't bland. There was some color.
You liked all the tweed?
I did.
All the tweed.
I did. I loved it. The stockings.
Really nice.
I loved how Keira Knightley looked. I just loved... It just gave me something a little bit different than what I'm normally used to. Sometimes it can be very bland and whatnot, but I thought that the women really popped in this.
Amongst all the blues and greens and browns in this film, it felt very clean.
Yeah.
Very put together.
And I like that. So let's talk a little bit too. The other thing we didn't talk about that it's estimated this movie cost anywhere between $14 and $16 million to make. Not too shabby, considering what's in this movie. And it does require, I believe, some special effects. I mean, our warplanes, our submarines.
They had to build a machine.
They had to build the machine, and which...
Only cost them like $48,000 as opposed to $100,000.
Yeah, and I love, too, the story about building this machine, how, they had to make it bigger than the actual. And they put in more... like wiring, and I didn't think of it, but they liken the wire to veins, to like blood vessels. So this thing was pumping life and working, and everything had to turn around. The machine looked great.
And a smart choice. I think they took a lot of the internal mechanisms and put them on the outside.
On the outside.
So we would understand.
But think about it too. When you look at even like a War Games, okay? Mm-hmm. Think about how this machine worked with its circle spinning. When you look at a War Games movie, all those computers have those disks spinning and stuff. So you could see, even from science fiction, this is the inspiration.
It's everything turning. It's making sense. Yeah. No, it's a great depiction.
The production design was great, too. The Weinsteins purchased this movie for $7 million. Now, here to me is what's fantastic. So we opened up at 4 locations this past weekend, and it opened up in the top 20. In the top 20 for 4 locations.
Yeah, I looked into this a tiny bit, and to kind of show you what that means, is it was right next to on the list, Whiplash, brought in about the same amount of money. I think there was like a $10,000 difference, and there was like a 100 theater difference.
Right.
Like four theaters making as much as Whiplash, which also had rave reviews, tons of people. Coming in just above it. I mean, it has been out for a while.
Whiplash has been out for a while, so I will give it that.
But that many theaters? That's crazy.
I understand. Yeah, it is. But Whiplash is... When did it come out? What are we in right now? December? November?
But I don't think it didn't start really getting hype until it'd been out for like a month.
Yeah. I mean, but it's been out, and this one has Benedict Cumberbatch. I mean, I don't see anybody hotter right now, to be honest. I mean, as far as acting goes, this is sort of kind of like that.
You could throw Jennifer Lawrence out there.
Sure. Well, yeah, no, you could, but she... no offense to her. She's not going to get nominated, I don't think, for Hunger Games. I think that he's going to get nominated. It's sort of kind of like that similar heat that Matthew McConaughey was going into the award season. Now, I'm not predicting that at this point that Benedict will win, although he's generating this heat, and he's, like you said, so likable.
Exactly. There is Christoph Waltz. He's the other one who I think... I'm not talking about for this season, but like they have a very similar heat right now, where both of them are kind of like darlings, acting darlings.
Yeah, and I don't know. I just think that right now, and like he and the Weinsteins are doing everything right going into the nomination season. We're looking at an opening weekend domestic gross of like $479,000, $392. So at 4 locations, if I do the math right, well, I just looked it up, it's $119,838. I'm not Alan Turing. Mm-hmm. So that's a huge per screen average. Mm-hmm. To date, the domestic gross is roughly $600,000 estimated. Mm-hmm. And worldwide box office is about 16 mil.
I was going to say, because like, so what we do need to England realize, exactly,
this number has been huge.
This is a national release in England, so they're doing very well. It's getting, I want to say it's so much higher than like Iron Lady over there. They like,
yeah,
if
it's
you look
huge
into it, people are loving it, seeing, mm-hmm, going out to see it over there. So
yeah,
that's
it's
really where it's focused.
Yeah,
money.
So and I think if you take away 4 million of that is the rest of the foreign domestic. So about 12 million plus in England, plus 4, that's 16 or so. It's about 16 million overseas. Very wise investment for the Weinstein Company. I think it further proves Benedict Cumberbatch's popularity. He was I don't think people really appreciate the popularity of Sherlock. That show in the BBC is just like, it's huge. The mere fact, and he continues to do the show. He's starting to become a go-to kind of guy. He just signed on as Doctor Strange. So he doesn't necessarily need Sherlock, but he continues to do it. And so there's going to be another season coming up, which, you know, everybody's like loving this. That show's only gaining in popularity. Elementary is the CBS. I think it's on CBS show.
There we
go. The other Sherlock Holmes. So in any case, so 86% on Rotten Tomatoes, which is fresh. And if you're going from Rotten Tomatoes audience poll, they have it at a 93%. So audiences,
which is really high.
Log on. Yeah.
Especially box office.
Yeah. For this movie.
Talking about, it's higher than The Hunger Games.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That's impressive.
Yeah. No. And I think going into the holiday season with all this buzz going on and going for it, it's riding a wave. And it's riding a wave that, you know, the Benedict Cumberbatch fans are going to go out and see it. I don't think people are necessarily going to be disappointed. You're not bored.
Not at all.
I don't think you're going to be bored by this movie at all. I think you're really going to like this movie. When I go home for the holidays, I might, you know, if it's playing in Boston, by that time I would suspect I would go take my mom to this movie, or I'd go with my dad. My brother, I think, would love this movie. So all in all, like, they're doing really well. Now we've got movies like The Theory of Everything. We have other we have the Bradley Cooper American Sniper.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say Shooter.
Yeah.
That's not right.
Mark Wahlberg.
There we go.
But American Sniper, we have yet to see. I have yet to see Exodus. So, you know, who's not up for a 3-hour and 40-minute biblical epic? So, again, I reserve. But right now, I say that Imitation Game, best movie out there to go see for this.
If I had
right now
to tell people what to see currently that's in theaters and at specialty, I would definitely say Imitation Game, Theory of Everything, Whiplash, those three right now. I think are strong.
Final thoughts with Imitation Game?
I think that a lot of people are going to want to push this movie into a box before they see it.
Interesting.
I think they're
what kind of box?
Into the specialty box office, they're going to think it's slow, it's about math, it probably has a good acting performance, but it's not going to be something that's relatable or truly entertaining. And I don't want people to put it in that box. I think that if I'm going to tell any of my friends about it, I want to tell them it is something that keeps you guessing and makes you want to think and makes you curious. And you do end up caring for the characters.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's more than what people are going to just want to label it as.
Yeah, and I personally think they're going to get out of that box. I think that with word of mouth and with the proper marketing that they've been doing, I thought they've had good marketing too, by the ways. And you can, for Golden Globes, you can get this as an ensemble cast too.
True.
As well. So I think nominations are going to help this movie. I think if you market the espionage aspect and the code breaking and, you know, and this man's hiding a secret, that'll go well. You know, fingers crossed. I mean, I'm hoping that, you know, because I've talked about it. I've been caught in hyper vortexes with a couple of movies. This one met my expectations on the hype going in. It delivered for me from a hype standpoint. Because I was hearing a lot about this movie, and I saw it, and I was like, this lived up to the hype.
I agree.
So you agree as well? And you've seen this movie 1.5 times, 2 times, something like that?
Somewhere in between there.
Okay.
Somewhere in between 1 and 2 times I've seen this movie. And it keeps getting better, and I would see it again.
Yeah, same here. So, well, Sarah, where can people find you as we start wrapping this wonderful show?
Here on Popcorn Talk, The Anatomy Movie. I also do Box Office Breakdown, which we put up on Mondays, so you guys should check that out. Also, subscribe. Subscribe to Popcorn Talk Network, guys.
Go into YouTube. It's so easy to do. Popcorn Talk Network or Popcorn Talk on YouTube, I believe
it
is.
Yeah, you can search it.
Yeah.
Subscribe, comment, you know,
it's,
those things.
Yeah, it's a wonderful, it's a great thing to be a part of. What Maria and Kevin and Phil, to a great extent, what they've done, their vision of 24/7, it's talk about movies, mm-hmm. whether it's the Schmoes Know, Jedi Alliance, Screen Junkies, Anatomy of a Movie, anything you want to talk about movies, yeah. It's right there. And please be a part of our conversation. Watch the movie. Please come back. Let us know what you think. Maybe we missed something. Maybe you agree or disagree. Be kind. But, you know, just let us know, because talking about movies is what we do and it's what we love. So thank you for watching and thank you for listening. JT, thanks for the zeros and ones in the board over there. Good job. I hope you took your headphones off. JT did not see the movie, so I hope we didn't ruin it for
but
you.
But he wants to see it.
He's semi-ruined, but I'm still going to go see it for the great performance.
All right.
It's history. It can't be ruined.
It's history. So thank you very much for checking in with us. We'll see you next time at Anatomy of a Movie. Bye.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the rest of the Anatomy of a Movie staff, we would like to thank you for listening and subscribing to the show. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to email or tweet us. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been Anatomy of a Movie.